When we're headed out on a hike, some of the preparations we make are about avoiding stuff. We put on sturdy shoes or boots to protect our feet, a hat, long sleeves, and long pants if we're worried about scratches or bugs or poison ivy. We're eager to see and hear whatever the trail has to offer, but maybe we're missing something essential when it never occurs to us to touch anything. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Nikita Asad is a doctoral candidate in the history of science, medicine, and technology at Hertford College at the University of Oxford. In her recent essay for Eon, A Touch of Moss, she considers the way these plant species touch and interact with their environments and the ways that human touch is interactive as other senses are not. The only way to touch something is to make contact with it and to be touched back in return. Nikita, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. I'm really delighted to be here.
You write about this walk you took in the woods near your house about a year ago, and something about that particular walk made you really notice the moss that maybe you had overlooked on the same route in the past?
Yeah, that's about right.
Tell us a little bit about that experience.
So I'd gone with a few friends to the woods near my house where I live, Whiteham Woods near Oxford. And it was just the beginning of winter, and there was leaf sludge everywhere. And so there were these bare trees and an overcast sky, and it was all feeling very gloomy, and it was really dark. But the only thing that really caught my attention in that sense was moss, because it was literally glittering. So I could see it shining in front of me. But even that, I think, was something that didn't really make me go and touch it. It was just the texture of it in front of me on this wood, on this piece of log that was lying there. And as I looked at it, it spoke to me, and I thought I should maybe touch it. And yeah, I think that's how it started.
Did it feel the way you were expecting it to?
No, because I think the way that we often think about moss is that it's supposed to be a very soft, feathery carpet, in the way that sometimes it is used ornamentally at airports or homes and other places. These replicas of it, and normally it's produced and manufactured in plastic. And I was expecting something more soft, I suppose. But when I went and touched it, as much as it was soft, there were also these little stalks jutting out of it. And so I realized that it's a completely different world down there when you're at eye level with it and trying to touch it. There's so many different textures that you feel. It is feathery and rough at the same time.
What makes winter, as you call it, the true season of touching?
I think winters are the only time where you cannot escape touch. You can't escape the natural world, which maybe in some ways you can in other seasons, because even if it's not raining, a fog will enshroud you, or a raindrop will come and touch your hands, or even if you know you're fully covered and you're wearing a lot of jackets, even then some raindrop can touch your forehead or settle on your hair. And then you'll also feel your knuckles can turn blue, and you'll feel the prickly cold on your hands and on your body, which I think we don't feel that much in other seasons, where it's still possible to escape the season somehow in our temperature-controlled homes, or in our cars, or even while we're walking. So I think that sensation really comes home to us in winter.
Reading that made me think about how hard we work to seal nature out of our homes entirely, with the exception maybe of like a houseplant. But even that is growing in a designated pot. There's no risk that it's going to spread into the sink or the living room rug. It's this artificial divide that has become so familiar that it seems really normal to think of ourselves as distinct from nature.
Yeah, something that I'm working on right now is the difference between human and non-human, human and the natural world. And you're quite right that it seems to me that we have somehow really bought this idea that we are fundamentally different from the non-human world, from the natural world. But one thing that is common, which we share with the non-human world, with other beings, which may look and appear very, very different from us, radically different from us, and what we share with them is the sense of touch, because even if those beings perhaps can't hear or see, what they do experience is the sense of touch. And so I think that also was another way in which I entered this essay.
The other thing that I thought about is that most of us weirdly have this sense that it's most natural to get food wrapped in plastic. I mean, to your point that, you know, all the natural world is often touched by us. We get our food like warehoused on sterile store shelves, and it feels weirdly like transgressive to pick a piece of fruit off a tree and eat it unless we, you know, garden all the time or something.
Yeah, I have a lot of apple trees around where I live. And this autumn, I really wanted to bake an apple pie. And I suggested it to some of my friends, and some of them were thinking that maybe we can just go to one of the supermarkets and get it. What would be so special about plucking an apple and then doing it? And then when it came to actually plucking the apple, I had to think about a lot of things. I had to really revisit my lack of knowledge and think about how much I actually know about which apples I can use and what a color of apple says about it. And that just speaks to how much I don't know about the world in which I live. And it's really something that's cordoned off from me, and I'm very alienated from it. So I think when I touch it, whether it's an apple or a moss, it really reminds me of how out of touch I've become with it. Especially I think with food, because it's something that I am going to put inside my body. But I tend to think when it comes to me in this prepackaged form, or we tend to think that it's not a part of the natural world somehow. But I think that is actually one of the most intimate ways in which we engage with the natural world, right, in a very mass manufactured way. But I think it's the one of the revelations I had, I think, while I was working on this essay and a couple of other essays, is that no matter how much we think that we live in our sanitized homes and in our and the way that we engage with the world, we tend to think that it's something that we're somehow divorced from the natural world. But I think I quickly realized that it's just not possible to be, because at the end of the day, we do engage with it, whether we want to or not, whether we are conscious of it or not, but in obviously very sanitized and alienated ways. So yeah.
So as you started paying more attention to mosses and touching them when you found them, you began to think about how moss touches other things. How is it different from other plants in terms of like where and how it can grow?
So what makes moss different is that it is a non-flowering plant, which has stems and leaves, but it has no real roots to speak of. It can grow on most damp surfaces, such as you see it on footpaths or growing on walls or rocks or even your drain covers, your abandoned bicycles on the roofs and on cars. So essentially, it's the green stuff that we see around us that sometimes has pokey little heads coming out of it. And it's mostly you notice it on walls, on a box of trees, especially in winter. And as I was noticing it, I initially used to think, you know, when I was growing up, that maybe it's a parasite or it's a fungi. But the truth is that it doesn't derive its moisture and contents from the surface on which it is growing. So it's not taking anything from the surface, from the bark or the wall on which it's growing, but it's drawing moisture from the air, the water, and the sun. So in addition to that, it's also sheltering a lot of other insects, which it comes in direct contact with. So it literally becomes a home for a lot of tiny bugs, which then become food for birds and their young ones. So in a way, instead of taking anything from the surface on which it grows, it's actually giving back to the natural world in so many other ways to these bugs that then become food for birds. And it's been doing that for about 450 million years. So it's actually the first plant that we know that made the journey from water to land. And scientists have found that that we actually owe the fresh air in our atmosphere to moss, because it was moss that extracted carbon from the air and which created topsoil for the first vascular plants, the normal trees that we see now, which then led to an increase in oxygen, which led to life flourishing. So I think it's such a wonderful story that it all began from moss making their journey from water to land. And within water, it was in contact with water. And when it came to land, it also remained in contact with and continuously touching the air around it, and then the water molecules, and then finally the little insects that I was talking about.
I'm so glad to know this now, Nikita, and I'm sad that I didn't know it before. I feel like there ought to be like a World Moss Day where we all celebrate this organism.
Yeah, there should be a World Moss Day. Like it's absorbing water and nutrients from its one-celled leaves, just one-celled leaves, and they can hold water up to 30 times their own weight, which is incredibly rare and bizarre in the natural world. And I was really struck by it when I was looking at moss, and I remember this a couple of times it happened that it's always raining here, right? So when it was raining, I looked at a moss bed and the sporophytes, those little capsules, the brown pokey heads, and there was these capsules and they were holding water droplets. Each capsule was holding one water droplet. And then I'd go about my day and I'd come back and it would still be holding water. That is its ability to retain. And it almost feels like it has the ability to pause time.
Why is our sense of touch less likely to lead us to objectify things we become aware of than, say, our sense of sight?
So one way to answer that would be to look at the history of sight and touch and perhaps compare it. Philosophically, the history of sight or the way that we have engaged with the world around us when we look at it is perhaps to objectify it and not necessarily make it a part of our world or our own selves, because it is something out there which we are looking at. And it's not, we think so. I do think that it does make an influence on us unconsciously, but at least on a very superficial and facetious level, it looks as if we are divorced from it and we do not have to do any more than looking at it. So the classic example that Sartre, the French philosopher, built upon was that when you are looking at somebody and they return your gaze, only then you feel that you are somehow, you feel threatened by them, or in the sense you realize that you're not the only one who is building and constructing this world, and you're not the only self that there is. There is also an other that can other you. But that only happens when that other is a human other, when that human other is looking at you and then making you think about, okay, I'm not the only one in the world. There are other people who can also look at me and make me the object. But when it's a non-human, when it's a moss or an animal or a plant or something that doesn't respond to our gaze in the way that humans do, doesn't reflect, we tend to think that we, very much I think it's, we tend to think wrongly, it's not correct, but still we tend to think this, that we are the only ones, or we are the ones who are responsible for the constitution of our world and the world more generally. When it comes to touch, however, there is no fiction there. There is no possibility of having this fiction of an independent self or this independent person who's built her own world. Because when you touch something, you are in contact with it. And you come into contact with it without knowing whether you are doing the touching or whether it is doing the touching. The most radical potential of touch that I feel and have thought about, and like other philosophers have thought about, is that touch is something that really exposes us to the inevitability of others.
Nikita, it occurs to me that unlike sight or hearing, touch can really only happen on an intimate scale, right? We can see a huge portion of the sky or the Grand Canyon. We can hear what seems like the entire ocean or a thunderclap that's thousands of feet above. We can only touch things we're right up close to.
Yeah. That's quite correct. And that means that when you touch something that's in front of you, you are situated in that particular place. So with sight, it seems as if you are everywhere and nowhere. And that can lead to a very dangerous fiction in which you become the sole owner of your own world in that sense. Whereas with touch, it's always that interaction. And that leads to an interesting thought-provoking conversation about subjectivity, about how we engage with people around us, not only non-humans, but also humans around us. And I think that perhaps also can lead to a kind of humility and an acceptance that it's all interconnected, that we are dependent upon each other in more ways than we realize.
When did the study of mosses start to be taken seriously by botanists?
So broadly speaking, it was in the 16th century that people started taking interest in mosses, but a scientific study began in the 17th century, and we see that at Oxford, actually, by Johann Jakob Delenius, a German botanist. Delenius had initially studied medicine in Germany, but while he was there, he also developed a really keen interest in mosses and plants that were originated around the place where he lived in Gießen. And while he was doing that, he authored a book on cryptogams. These were plants that reproduce via spores, or the lower plants, which we now know were mosses and lichens. And then he came to Britain and he became the first Rhodian professor of botany at Oxford University. And that's how I also happened to come upon his research and his Phynaxis, his account of the way that he collected mosses and identified different types of fungi and liverworts and other ferns and equistems and all of those lower plants, technically. And it was in 1732 that he had started thinking of this project, that he's going to write a book on the history of mosses. And he really just wanted to do this, write a book on the mosses in England. But he had a lot of struggles because he was an immigrant in Britain, and he had authored a book while he was here, which did not bear his name because other botanists at the time and his peers thought that people wouldn't appreciate the name of a foreigner on a book in England. So eventually, when he died in 1747, his History of Mosses, the abridged version of it, remained incomplete. He had published a History of Mosses before, which was 576 pages long, and it's an exceptional piece of work. But he couldn't do what he really wanted to do with it.
When you learned about Delenius and his work, what made him feel like a kindred spirit over all those centuries?
First, I was really struck that who wants to spend all of their time looking at mosses? So I was really curious and I wanted to know what kind of a person he was. And then I was heartbroken because I couldn't find a lot about it. He didn't leave any memoirs, so to speak. But he did leave letters from which you can glean the sense of a person who was struggling because he was an immigrant. And I think that was another parallel, I suppose, between my experiences here and his experiences. And then I realized that where I live, he had also probably walked here and looked at mosses growing on maybe some of these in trees or on trees or on the pavement and the footpath where I walk. And so I kept his illustrations at hand. I kept the book with me and I looked at them. I looked at his book, the illustrations that he had drawn. And I think, yeah, I think developed a picture began to form in my head of this person who would draw these illustrations at night by a lamp. And during the day, he would be gazing at them and touching them.
You also had an appreciation for the kind of attention he was paying, right? I mean, mosses don't announce their presence to somebody walking along in quite the same way that a towering tree or a plant full of flowers might do.
Yeah, it doesn't. You really have to reorient yourself and you have to pay really close attention to it. And even if you do it, it's not something that's going to sustain your interest for more than a minute or 5 minutes, or because it's not something that is, there's not a lot going on there which you can engage with. Whereas with the tree, you can climb up a tree, you can pluck something, you can pluck a fruit, or you can play with its leaf, or you can look at birds. Whereas with a moss bed, it's something that's right in front of you. But you can't do much with it. You just have to be there and let it be. And I think that also speaks to this impulse we have with regard to nature, that it has to be something that we either take home, or it has to be something in the sense of a plant or something else, or it has to be something that I taxonomize or collect as a scientist. But a moss bed is something, I think it invites a different kind of attention where I let it be, where I respect its privacy in a way, and where I respect its own being, which I may not feel so comfortable or may not be used to doing to a tree where I can just, pluck a leaf and go home and be on my way.
I really appreciated your perspective on this because you are originally from a town in Punjab, India. What's different about the way Indian naturalists and Western ones categorize plants like mosses?
I wouldn't really want to generalize it, to be honest,
okay.
because there also are a lot of similarities, especially in the contemporary world. And before Linnaeus, before the Swedish botanist Carl Linnaeus, and before the time of Telenius, there were also other forms of classifications that were present in the Western world, which were similar to the Eastern world, broadly speaking. However, some differences that I did come across when I was looking at Telenius and then the centuries following Telenius was that in Indian texts of Ayurveda, for example, plants would be classified into different categories on the basis of their shape or texture or appearance, sometimes also on the basis of their habitats and other medicinal properties and remedial benefits. But post-Linnaeus, you see that in the Western world, it's on the basis of their sexual reproduction, or on the basis of how they look, how they appear to us. Whereas when I was looking at different words for moss in Punjabi, which is my mother tongue, then we call it kai. And kai is something that could mean that moss is growing on a rock, or moss is birthed by a rock, or moss is frozen over the rock. So there's multiple meanings of it. But one thing that I can say with some confidence is that, for example, the word for moss or other words for a hornwort in Punjabi and in Hindi are words that speak to their embeddedness in nature and what it is that they are in contact with, what it is that they are touching. So something like a hornwort would have a word in Hindi or Punjabi, which would mean that it's a plant growing in water. It's a plant that's touching water. And kai is, which is the word for moss, is essentially something that's slippery. So it already has a connotation of touch built into it. And I think that's something that I didn't feel when I was looking at the etymologies of moss. However, it is something that we often think, that tend to think in English as a carpet, that moss is a carpet or a bed, but it's something that can be removed, that can be scraped. Whereas in Punjabi, it's something that is a part of the rock somehow, because the rock is somehow birthing it, is giving birth to it.
That's such a beautiful phrase, and it really does sort of place this organism in context, like it's not itself if it's pulled up from where it originally existed.
Yeah.
You note that Western cultures have turned different kinds of mosses into commodities, right? We use peat as a kind of fertilizer. We use moss as a decoration. We use it as like a plant to, you know, look pretty in places. This is not the case in Punjab?
Actually, it's not the case. Yeah. As much as I do not want to generalize, I couldn't find, I don't think that this business will ever be successful. Partly because I think there's, of course, there's a lot of economic context to go with it. What opportunities are people afforded? Whether aesthetic is a sense that that people can afford to have in their homes. And there's the whole political economy to go by. But yeah, no, it's not something that you see in Punjab.
Do you think the language around moss in Punjabi might also have something to do with that? Because, you know, people, based on the words, are encouraged to think of it as a thing that sort of belongs where it grows.
That is quite possible, yeah. That it's something, if it's a part of the rock somehow, then maybe you take the rock inside your home instead of scraping the moss and taking it inside your home. So moss does grow, obviously, on rocks everywhere in Punjab as well. And then you see it in people's gardens, but it's very much a natural part of their gardens. They haven't intentionally brought it there. It's not ornamental in that sense. It's just considered a part of the environment, a very fundamental part of it, but not something that either beautifies it or something that is dangerous or something that can be commodified.
You draw a fascinating link here between British botanical expeditions during imperial times and British colonization. Did that hunt for plants lay the groundwork for Europeans to assume they could sort of possess entire landscapes with flourishing cultures that had been there for thousands of years?
I wouldn't say that there is such a linear link between these expeditions and colonialism, but I would say that they were happening simultaneously. And also that both humans and non-humans were considered as objects to be controlled, to be which can be manipulated and maneuvered by colonialists. And so when I was thinking about moss, about touching moss, I was thinking about who has the opportunity to touch moss, who has had the opportunity to engage with moss in this very scientific way, and how did these different kinds of mosses happen to be collected by Delenius or other people or other kinds of plants? And then obviously from my research, which is history of science, I looked at Kew Gardens, and I looked at the Calcutta Botanic Garden and British Museum, National History Museum in UK. And all of them have very strong links to colonialism, because without colonialism, it wouldn't have been possible for botanists to accompany other colonial officers on expeditions around the globe and then collect plants. Like one example that I often give is a Hans Sloane, who collected such a great, well, not great, but all such a huge collection of plants, which eventually led to the formation of the Natural History Museum. And he did that, he started doing that in Jamaica in the 1690s, which is right in the middle of transatlantic slave trade, where millions of people were enslaved. And he hired some of these enslaved people to collect specimens for him, and then he brought these specimens here. So I think there's a very visceral, real link and connection between botany and colonialism, modern botany and colonialism. And even after that, when he came back, there were slave traders and surgeons and other medical practitioners who were providing him information and supplying him specimens. And that's how the National History Museum came to be. And we see that also in the Kew, the Royal Botanic Gardens in the UK here, where there was that it became a kind of center for exchanging information about plants throughout the British Empire. And it was at the Kew Gardens that a lot of specimens and plants were brought from the tropics of all of each hemisphere. And I think that it says something, it allowed me to think about touch and touching moss in a historical sense, but also I think in a more responsible way, because I think sometimes touching nature is seen, you can consider that, okay, touch nature, it's good for your soul, it's good for your health, it's going to reconnect you to nature, and all of that is great. But then there's also the question of who can touch nature, who has been allowed to touch nature.
You know, when you talk about these institutions that colonial era botanists set up, it also strikes me that they were like deeply curious about what they considered to be, organisms from these places, maybe not nearly so curious about the human beings who lived there and their cultures.
Yes, and that's the tragedy. I think that they actually may have regarded these, they did regard these objects more important than the people. As I told you, that they would employ people who were enslaved to do the touching for them, quite literally, collect it for them. And they would rely upon their knowledges, their indigenous knowledges about these plants. But then they wouldn't respect those people as human beings, let alone as people who were actually intelligent and brave and had their own healing systems and epistemologies. So I think that one of the examples that when I was looking at it was in Jamaica, for example, there were people who were employed by Sloan, but also by other botanists. And what he'd promised them was that maybe some kind of freedom or some security, but eventually it didn't work out because he left, and then they were left to fend for themselves.
So, yeah, it almost feels like a willful kind of like it would be a challenge to maintain that kind of cognitive dissonance, to care so little about these people that you recognized had expertise in this subject that you were interested in, the plants.
I think so, but also I don't think that when they were interested in these plants, they were necessarily respecting these plants or these species. I think there's that difference between this impulse to collect and taxonomize. And also, they were interested in collecting and taxonomizing because they were botanists, And at the same time, there were commercial interests. Because, for example, when with Indigo Plantation, there was a clear commercial and economic interest for them. That's what they wanted to do in India, for example. So they wanted that at the company's botanic garden in Calcutta, for example, in the 1780s, commerce was really important for them. And then they wanted to identify plants that can be used as dyes or timber. But then later on, it also became a premier scientific institute where one of the aims of the institute was to collect and classify India's diverse flora. However, the project of identifying and locating where plants can be used as dyes and forcing Indian farmers into growing indigo instead of food crops, that remained as important as collecting indigo for indigo's sake. Both these projects were simultaneously going on at this institute, and I think the latter was even more. The latter was, I suppose, enabled by the former. So it was commerce and this interest in colony because they wanted to profit off of it, crudely speaking, that it was even possible for botanists to come to India and then collect these plants and become interested in indigo in the first place. While what was happening with people at the same time was that these laborers were brought into factories where they were kept in debt through the indenture system. This was like a contractual agreement, which basically bought them for providing food and clothing and some basic accommodation. So there is a whole history here of extracting and exploiting both people and plants.
Your essay made me think about the ways that colonizers had the sense that they could touch anything they desired, right? They could come in and build things and upend entire cultures and systems of governance because they wanted something that these places possessed. But they were also like weirdly resistant to being touched back, right? To the extent that they could recognize the humanity of the people who lived in those places they wanted to control. They weren't all that curious about the people themselves.
They weren't curious about the people at all, I think, except that they would, I suppose, exoticize people. And also, because this is also the period where race science is at its peak in the 19th century, it's known as, the century of race science, I suppose. And so, as much as they were classifying plants, they were also classifying people. They were classifying animals, they were categorizing animals, and they were also doing that to people. There was this whole ideas about whether we come from one human ancestor, which is the belief in one, this is called the one race theory, the monogenism versus the polygenism, which is that we come from different ancestors because we have different skin colors. So there is also that debate going on, and it's being debated in scientific circles. And you see that that's happening on in other levels on a craniotomy with the study of skulls, which is happening in even the early 20th century. And at the same time, plants are being classified. So it's really science itself at this time, I think, is almost becoming hegemonic in the sense that it believes in the story of itself that it has the right to everything on the planet, including people, plants. However, I would say that this is very much a broad, sweeping statement and generalization. Of course, there were a lot of exceptions in this. And you're quite right, though, about touching, because I was just reminded of when you said this about Anne Laura Stoller's work. This is a historian, a feminist historian who's worked on imperial bodies. And she looks at how women were looked at, how women were sexualized by and touched in so many and abused and assaulted in other ways by colonizers. So yeah, it was really the colonial presence was something that was threatening to both plants, people, women, and everybody in general, I think.
Actual historians of science, as you are, may not make this mistake, but I think, Nikita, that the way sort of the general public thinks about the history of science is that those kinds of mistakes and oversights that colonial era people, that race science era people made, those are relics of the past. We want to believe that we've come beyond that and we aren't susceptible to this anymore. What is your sense of is that maybe a misplaced confidence that science has now moved beyond these mistakes?
Science has definitely learned from these mistakes, but it hasn't moved beyond them. I think it is something that we keep coming back to, and we have seen that with COVID-19, that how it became something that was instrumentalized by the far right to target certain communities. It happened in the case of India, for example, where I'm from. The far right was trying to blame the Muslim community for it because India has become a very Islamophobic nation. And we saw that in other places as well, where science has been used in different ways. And that's one thing to say about science. But the other is also that scientists are people that are embedded in society. And so they themselves are susceptible to not only committing mistakes, but as opposed to being people who believe in other kinds, who believe in fascism, who believe in racism. And I think it's high time perhaps now that we think about science not in fundamental terms, not as God's gift that I suppose people used to think in the 16th century or 17th century, but as something that's as human as anything else that we've made.
You remind us in this essay of the story of King Midas, which, you know, is often framed as a tale that is only about greed. It is that, but it's also a different kind of deeper tragedy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And when I was thinking about this, it's something that stung me was really his loneliness. That when you can't touch anything without harming it, and that made me think that, well, that is the story for all of us, isn't it? That everything that we have touched, especially in the natural world, we've ended up harming it somehow. And that is such a loss, because I think touch has such a radical potential of reminding us of our reciprocity and of reminding us that we are not the most important beings there are in the universe. But what we have done is that everything that we have touched somehow has become something that we've either tamed or brought into our lives in a non-reciprocal, exploitative way. And I think that when I was touching mosses and when I was like, it's during that I was reminded of the story of Midas, and I was reminded that as much as I think touch has all this potential, touch is also something that's very dangerous and risky. And this is something that everybody who's been in any relationship, you know, can tell us, that touch is something that is so intimate, and with that intimacy comes the possibility of exploitation and power. And so I was reminded of how I used to play touch and go with my friends when I was a kid. And I remember that, you know, you basically are trying to touch the other person, you're running towards them. But if you touch them, if you're also, there is the possibility of hurting them. And so you have to run towards them, but you also have to make sure that you don't hurt them. You have to touch them softly, gently. And that is the kind of touch that I think I wanted to get at.
What have you learned about how we can thoughtfully and respectfully incorporate touch into our encounters with nature?
I think, first of all, when we touch something, I would like as to think of touch as something that is a very complex and layered sense perception. It's not as easy as touching nature and building an effective, intimate relationship with it, because when I touch it, I think, at least I was certainly reminded of the histories of touching nature as something that we've been speaking about. At the same time, I do wonder if we can cultivate touch as something that is an exposure to the natural world, something that maybe hurts me a little bit. I don't mean physically, but I mean emotionally and effectively, in the sense that it reminds me of how we have touched nature, how we have touched each other, but also something that can heal us, that has that healing power. Because Something as simple as when somebody is upset and you go and hug them, the power of touch, you know, that we often speak about in psychology. And I think that therein lies the potential of touch. It is very much a double-edged sword, I sometimes think, because of what we have done to touch rather than what touch has done to us. So I think that if I return to that kind of touch where it is a resilient sense that the body has, as well as something that I was looking at that etymology. It comes from the French word touche, which I talk about in my essay also, which could also mean an attack. So I think that when I want to touch nature, I want to revel in it, I want to relish it, but at the same time, I also want to be reminded of my responsibility towards it. I want to be conscious of what I owe to it.
Yeah, that awareness is really interesting. You note in the essay that touch is the only sense that we can't block. You know, we can close our eyes or close our mouths or plug our ears. We can't help but touch things. And yet, we're really good at ignoring the things we are touching, right? Most of us don't walk around really being super conscious of our feet on the floor or the clothes on our bodies. Maybe we need to be a little more sensitive to what we're experiencing.
Yeah, we definitely need to be. It reminds me of a poem, actually, by Ada Limón, from her new collection, The Hurting Kind. I think it's the last poem, and it's called The End of Poetry. And essentially, she's just saying that we have had enough of sunflowers and meadows and self and the annihilation of the self. And she goes on, it's a list for him, that enough of all of that. And she says that, I am asking you to touch me. And I think that is what I want, that we have looked at nature and heard it, and it has done a lot of things for us. But I think maybe it's time that we touch it in the way that it matters, in the way that it exposes us to the wounds that we have inflicted upon it and ourselves while engaged in that project.
Do you feel like becoming interested in mosses might have led to you changing in some permanent, fundamental way?
I think now when I can't ever avoid mosses. I suppose that whenever I'm out, I'm always looking at different kinds of mosses now. That, okay, this is the one which is, if it's glittering, it's the glittering wood moss, or there is, if it's a silver moss, then it's spider magenta moss. It's a very technical academic sense. I think that I've just begun to appreciate mosses more. But also, I think I've become more sensitive to touch, to the potential that my hands and my body has. Where, for example, when I feel estranged from something in front of me, and if it allows me to touch it, I will go and touch it. And that maybe will make me feel a little bit more better, but at the same time, also cautiously better, I guess.
Nikita Azad is a doctoral candidate in the history of science, medicine, and technology at Hertford College at the University of Oxford. Her recent essay for Eon was titled A Touch of Moss. Nikita, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time to talk with us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think, or use that search term wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to ours. It's free. You can also get to the podcast at our website, where you can also sign up for our free e-newsletter and learn about upcoming shows we're planning. That's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.